Well, please open your Bibles to the passage that we've just read this evening from 1 Samuel and chapter 17, and we shall consider verses 1 through to 58. 1 Samuel 17 and verses 1 through to 58. If you're using the church Bible, that's on page 288. How many times a day does the world tell us that an awesome and a powerful look equals victorious success? Because life often demands, doesn't it, that champions look this way. They look awesome. They look powerful. Only when you look like that can you be classed as being victorious. If you don't look like that, life doubts us. Life writes us off. And life will, frankly, on occasion, just chuck us away. So as we get into this, I want us to imagine that we're going on a trip. We're going on a trip to the British Museum for one of those tours through Bible history. Some of you might have been on one of those tours with Clive Anderson up to the British Museum. So that's where I want us to think that we're going. Now, the coach that we have hired for the day is going up the A3, but unfortunately, we get a puncture. And then somebody at the front of the coach makes a phone call, and that's because people at the front of coaches just have that sense of responsibility to everyone else on the coach. So they make this phone call, and they're telling us that help is on the way. Now, the first thing that we expect to see coming is a powerful, silver, shiny BMW police car coming in alongside us and making the A3 nice and safe for us. And then the next thing that we expect to see is a powerful breakdown lorry with bright flashing orange lights pulling alongside us as well. And we expect the mechanic from that powerful lorry to have his high-vis jacket on with special reflective patches. He must smell of warm oil. He must have a stubbly chin. He must have big black boots with reinforced toe caps. But instead, you hear this. And pulling up alongside you, stopping beside us on this coach, is a small moped. There's no flashing lights. There's no high-vis jacket. There's no stubble. There's no black boots. It's just a normal bloke carrying a small rucksack full of tools. We're on our coach, and we're looking down from our seats, and we're saying to one another, is this really the man that has come to save our day? Sometimes we can feel like this about King Jesus. The world looks so awesome, so powerful, so victorious. It looks like it has got all the answers. You say the cross of Jesus, his church, well, sometimes it just feels like defeat. It just looks like we're beaten, doesn't it? Well, if we've ever felt like that, please know this to be true. In 1 Samuel 17, we're going to see that God uses an unlikely looking man to save his people. God uses an unlikely looking man to save his people. You'll remember from our reading that Israel is in deep trouble. The Philistines are at war with God's people. Look out with me at the first part of verse 1. Now the Philistines gathered their forces for war and assembled at Soco in Judah. Now, the Philistines were not at Soco just to make up the numbers. The Philistines loved fighting. They used iron to make their weapons, and they loved drinking booze. So, a desire to fight, quality iron weapons, plus booze equals a nightmare. Now, the Bible tells us that the Philistines originally lived in Crete. But as with all things of man, the joy of Crete eventually began to fade. So the Philistines used another skill. They got in their boats and they sailed across the Mediterranean until they arrived in ancient Palestine. And from there they pushed into Canaan and they built five big cities: Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, Gath, and Ekron. Far from being dull and unsophisticated, the Philistines meant business. And for about 200 years, the Philistines were a constant pain for the children of God. So, a valley full of fight-happy Philistines wasn't so unusual for Israel, but on this occasion there's a big twist in the proceedings, because the Philistines have turned up to fight on this occasion with a giant on their side, Goliath of Gath. Look at verse 4 with me. A champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out of the Philistine camp. His height was 6 cubits and a span. Now, the Bible tells us that Goliath of Gath was awesome to look at. The Bible begins by describing Goliath as being 3 meters tall. Now, I don't know how tall you are, Peter. 120, right. So it's Peter and a whole lot more, okay, basically. The guy is a giant, and Goliath is massive. He's absolutely huge. But he is not like a skinny latte, right? He's not like a beanpole with no shoulders, okay? This guy had the world look of victory about him. He was an enormous vision of bloodthirsty bronze. Starting from the top, his helmet was bronze. His armor, which weighed about as much as a suitcase full of things for going away on holiday with, that was made of bronze as well. His light spear or javelin, that was made from bronze. And the greaves that he wears on his legs, or the armor that he wears on his legs, they were made of bronze too. Picking up the iron theme from just a few moments ago, we learn that the nasty end of his spear was made of iron. And it weighed as much as 18 cans of full-fat Coke in your plastic shopping bag. Imagine that. What a weight. He had a sword, and he was protected by a man who walked in front of him carrying a shield. Goliath of Gath looked awesome and powerful. He looked victorious in every way. He also spoke like he had the victory as well. From verses 8 to 16, the Bible tells us that for 40 days, morning and evening, Goliath of Gath shouted at God's people. He told them the same thing each time. He told them that he defied the armies of the living God. He told them that Israel was as good as dead. He told Israel she would become a nation of slaves. Goliath scared God's people, and he made them tremble and feel unhappy. Does the powerful and awesome look of this world ever make you tremble? Does it ever leave you feeling unhappy? Does this world shout in your face because you are found in the camp of the living God? The children of Israel need protection. They need someone to step in and save them from certain death. But the problem is, as we've read this passage, it doesn't seem that anybody is able to do it. Every time Goliath comes to the front line, the men of Israel run away. They need someone to step in. Well, the situation changes for them when David arrives at the front line. God is about to use an unlikely-looking man to save his people. In every way, David of Judah is nothing like Goliath of Gath, nothing like him at all. From the Bible, we see that out of 8 brothers, David is the youngest. He looks after sheep, so he's a man of the countryside, and his role would often be unglamorous and unseen. Now, the Bible also tells us that David was used by his father to serve others at the front line. Look at verses 17 to 18 with me. Now, Jesse said to his son David, "Take this ephah of roasted grain and these 10 loaves of bread for your brothers and hurry to the camp. Take along these 10 cheeses to the commander of their unit. See how your brothers are and bring back some assurance from them." So David's introduction to the battle lines at Soko is hardly spectacular. He's carrying food to the camp, basically. But despite the bread and the cheese, this is no ordinary man from the countryside. Because when David sees Goliath and hears the threat to life, David is not scared. In fact, David wants to know what has been done to get rid of this insult, the one who's insulting the armies of the living God. But sadly, David's words are misunderstood by his family and also others at the camp. Between verses 26 and 33, David is spoken to in quite a harsh way. David's older brother, Eliab, he gets really angry, and he says some quite sarcastically cruel things to David. He reminds David that he's just a shepherd who looks after a few sheep out in the wilderness. And he accuses David of wanting to get like a front row seat with popcorn and coke to watch the slaughter of God's children. And he says that David's heart is conceited and wicked. That's David's brother speaking. Saul, who's in charge of God's people, doesn't get quite as angry, but he certainly has his doubts as he listens to David and as he looks at him. David just looks too young in the eyes of Saul. Saul rightly assesses he has no military training. Goliath of Gath has been on a jamboree of violence since he was a youth, since he was young. How can David stand in the face of this certain agent of death? But David doesn't panic. He doesn't let words hurt him, and nor does he allow the doubts of others to dissuade him. David assures Saul, he says, "Trust my work, believe in what I'm saying." Between verses 34 and 37, David explains that a shepherd's work requires far more than the world sees or assumes. When a lion or a bear stole one of the sheep, he rescued the sheep from the jaws of death by killing the aggressor. Eventually, Saul gives David permission to go. But David does not join the battle for God's people dressed in the clothes and armor of a warrior king. Look at the middle of verse 39 with me, where we pick up the phrase, "I cannot go." David says to Saul, "I cannot go in these." In other words, "I cannot go in this tunic and this armor that you've given me." And then he goes on, "I can't wear these clothes because I'm not used to them." So David takes the armor off. Then he took his staff in his hand, chose 5 smooth stones from the stream, and put them in the pouch of his shepherd's bag, and with his sling in his hand, approached the Philistine. David joins the battle for God's people, dressed as he is, a shepherd holding his staff, armed with 5 smooth stones and his sling. God is about to use an unlikely looking man to save his people. David and Goliath walk towards each other. Now, Goliath gets very angry as he looks at David, and I imagine him taking his helmet off his head, like he's rubbing his eyes, and he's trying to refocus on the picture that is unfolding before him. "This is no challenge at all," thinks Goliath. "This is an awesome power. This isn't a sight of victory coming to meet him. This is pathetic. This is weak. This is feeble. This is useless. What sort of champion for God is this?" And Goliath curses David by all the man-made gods his mind can muster. And Goliath tells David, "You're gonna die. You are going to die on this battlefield today." And Goliath tells David, "I'm going to make you into like a snack for the birds of the air and the animals of the ground." As the giant vision of blood-thirsty bronze pauses to catch his breath, David responds. Look at verses 45 to 47 with me. David said to the Philistine, "You come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I'll strike you down and cut off your head. This very day I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. All those gathered here will know that it is not by sword or spear that the Lord saves, for for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands. So the battle for God's people is on. David runs quickly to his position. He is at work for the living God. He is stepping between God's people and certain death. And as he does so, he prepares his sling. Now, I've been told that the stone that David fires at Goliath is likely to be just a little bit smaller than a tennis ball. Whatever the size, the shot is accurate, it is deadly, it is fast. And the stone sinks into Goliath's forehead. He falls face down. David runs over to the body of Goliath. He stands over the agent of death. This is a scene of success. It is a scene of victory. And using Goliath's own sword, David cuts off Goliath's head. As the blood flows, the Philistines run. God has used an unlikely looking man to save his people. At the start of our talk this evening, we thought about a significant life tension. How many times a day does the world tell us that an awesome and powerful look is what brings victory in this life? And this got us thinking about the worldview of looking the part. And so we imagined just a few moments ago that we were on a coach and we were going up the A3 to London, but we got a puncture. And then this man on a moped turns up and he is the man that's going to save our day and get us back on our journey up to the museum. But as we looked from our seat on the coach down on this moped man, we doubted that he could save us. He didn't have that look about him. He didn't look like he could help us. And people doubted David too. They doubted how he looked. They doubted his qualification to walk onto that battlefield for the living Lord. Compared with Goliath, David looked unable to save God's people. But do you remember what David said to Goliath? God's people are not saved by spears or swords. It is the Lord's battle. And the Lord chooses to battle using a shepherd, staff in hand. God used an unlikely looking man to save his people. But what about us? If I said that we are in a war, how would you react? We are in a war. Do we see that? You may think that's really heavy, and it is a heavy thing to say, because some of us might still have the sound of Wittering behind our ears. The sun has shone for 2 days straight, so why would you want to start talking about this? England are about to play Australia in cricket, which is great, and some of you know a bit more about cricket from what I said last week. The gully and cow corner. Our tablet devices, or whatever we write on, they've been upgraded for next week. There are dozens of things planned for next week. I've got SAT results to think about. I've got stacks of GCSE coursework to do. I've got A-levels approaching. University, the office, home life. Or very simply, you know what? My life is top dollar. It's totally ordered. Death, that's right at the bottom of things to do. Don't talk to me about that. It's truly inconvenient. But what I say gently is true. We are in a war. And that war, that enemy, is standing opposite us day after day, morning and evening, and it's shouting in our faces, young and old. On our own, we have no answer for this war, this thing called death. We have no answer for its timing either. We need someone to step in and save us. Who's going to do this? Are we going to look for that picture of world success, for world victory? A giant warrior bronzed with armor and weapons of war? Is that what we look to? Man-made success? Or are we going to look for a shepherd? Like David, people looked at Jesus and doubted who he was. Jesus' own family struggled to believe him. Jesus' hometown basically said, go away, we don't want you here. The leaders of the people, the religious leaders of the people, they doubted who Jesus was. And when the hour came for Jesus to step in between us and certain death, he looked nothing like a champion at all. This is not Jesus in soft focus. Jesus was the victim of false accusation. He was all alone because all his friends had run away. He was mocked by tough Roman soldiers. He was beaten to a pulp. And when they finally crucified him, they pinned him to a tree naked. It was utter humiliation for the Son of God. The world looked at David the shepherd and doubted him. The world looked at Jesus Christ crucified and cursed him. But the moment that Jesus cried out, "It is finished," and gave up his life, God showed all who were gathered to witness his Son's death that it would not be by spear or sword or bronzed armor that the Lord saves. The battle over death belongs to the Lord. We are saved by Jesus Christ crucified. Faith in Jesus means death cannot shout at us anymore. Isn't that good to know that in your heart, young or old or somewhere in the middle, because of Jesus Christ's death? Death itself cannot shout at us anymore. How does that shape your week as you prepare to leave this building and go out into the world? What a confidence, what a blessing, what a truth. Do you know that peace for yourselves? What is there not to love about the victory of Jesus Christ? His table behind us reminds us that he willingly gave his body. He willingly shed his blood to bring many sons, many daughters to glory. Our world looks like it's got a lot of power and a lot of authority. But there is not one power, there is not one authority on the face of this earth that can step in between us and certain death. Even if God's children look really weak and really small next to the giant powers and authorities of this life, brothers and sisters, don't lose heart. That's what David said, don't lose heart. An unlikely looking man has saved God's people.